This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. My guest today is Ron Baugh. He is a group leader at the CEO Global Network currently, but he has quite a history leading people and leading hospitality organizations, companies, restaurants, I guess, really, is what we're talking about. Williams Coffee Pub and Wendy's and all the way back to Weber's Burger. Who hasn't had a Weber's Burger at some point or another? And Ron and I today have just a lot of fun together talking about what makes a great leader and what are those little bits of business? What are those little steps that we all make? Those things, you know, you know, I like to talk about incrementalism. What are those things that allow us to get to the next rung on the ladder, I guess you could say. We talk about priority versus balance. We talk about being self-aware and about A players and how we encourage respect within, you know, and professional conflict. That's kind of interesting. And about being present all the time. Ron talks about 11 things that he's learned flipping hamburgers, because that's how it all started for him quite a few years ago. And sadly, I don't think he tells us how long ago that actually was. Anyway, we talk about unregulated mentorship. How cool is that? And the power of a thank you. So stay tuned. Coming right up, davidpecklive.com for more information about my own podcasting and writing. You can also donate to what I'm doing here and help support what's going on at Face to Face through patreon.com. And don't forget rabble.ca too for more information on my own podcasting. And they got a new exciting website that they've posted, so check it out soon. Ron Baugh coming your way. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here today in North Oakville, actually, not too far from where I live. And Ron Baugh is here with us today, and he's a I was going to say you were a former CEO, but I don't know if that's fair, Ron. Maybe it is. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to chatting with you. Thanks for having me on.
So we've got Canadian Tire, we got Harvey's, we've got the CEO Global Network. Everybody, I think, has had a Weber's Burger. If you live in Ontario, I think you've headed into cottage country at any point in time in your life, you've had a Weber's Burger. How has that played such a significant role in your life? You refer to it, I think, on your LinkedIn profile even.
Yeah. It is, that's a really good question. I don't know if I can do justice to the answer, but it, not only for me, for many, many young men and women, was a defining moment in my career, unknowingly at the time. I was a young person starting to work there as a kid, 17 years old. But I can tell you there's not a week that goes by in my business world or my life personally where the subject of Weber's doesn't come up. Either I raise it or someone asks me about it. And it's been, you know, 1978 was the first year I worked there.
Wow.
And so it's phenomenal to me that it's played that important a piece of my life, the way it's played out, and so grateful for the experience.
So one of those things that you were, I mean, you know, you look back and you start to understand.
Right.
The past makes sense. The dots connect. I mean, you're standing over the barbecue flipping burgers. You got no idea what's going on, do you, at that point?
Where
you're going, no idea. You know, what's happening. You know?
In fact, I was probably going the wrong way when I got that job quickly. And I think, you know, I really, you know, I joke about it, but I think I share with you the fact that that was a probably one of the best things that ever happened to me was getting the job there as a young kid. You know, it was really kind of lost in what direction I was headed. And that really helped me. Not only, you know, the management and the owner in Paul Weber, but, you know, the people I was associated with. I was really fortunate to be around really great kids who, you know, were supportive. So it, and it did become over the years. I spent 13 years there on and off. It did become
That's
more
a lot of burgers.
Yes, a lot of burgers. That's a lot of burgers. I love hamburgers. Still, to this day, I love a hamburger.
We should have done the interview at like Harvey's. They just opened an A&W around the corner here. So
Yeah,
like brand new, like a week old, maybe.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, the future seems to be in gourmet burgers, I guess, right?
Right.
The higher end burgers almost, you know. Better meat, more sustainable, you know, organic vegetables and so on. There's a few of those in this town, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, he was way ahead of his time. He he was a stickler for quality. He great, you know, he put his own butcher facility in the actual, you wouldn't know that going there, but they grind and patty.
This is...
At Weber's.
Right.
Yeah, Paul Weber Sr. did this years ago. And while he was a shy guy himself, he was a stickler for quality and for cleanliness, and he really paid attention to the detail and taught us to do the same thing.
Did you know that it was going to go on? I mean, it's gone on to be quite a company, hasn't it? Really? I mean, it's expanded beyond just the burger. I mean, you can buy burgers, Weber burgers, in the store now. I mean, hasn't it sort of grown outside of, is it Aurelia?
It has grown and shrunk. So it's gone through a growth period, and there was some expansion that was successful in some ways, and there were some parts that maybe weren't. But it's really back to its original roots, and it's been sold. So it's not owned by the Weber family anymore, but they've got a great guy who bought the restaurant. I was telling you, I wrote him a letter when he bought it, and not knowing him at all, but just outlining to him things that I thought that he shouldn't do. And I spent a lot of time on it, and he phoned me and said, you know, you're not alone. Like, you're not the only person I've heard from. And so there's a whole troop of us who were wanting to protect the identity. And you know, things have to change, things have to grow, and he's been really smart about that.
Sure,
But there's quite a loyal following of ex-employees that really would love to see the place prosper.
It's interesting, you know, so that was exactly where I was going. So you say loyal following of employees, you've talked about great people, you've talked about Paul. Sounds like he had an edge of humility to him.
Absolutely.
I mean, you drive north, and I've stopped in a couple times. I can't be bothered with the lineup. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous, talking about loyalty. You know, people parking on the other side, and I don't know, I've seen ridiculously long lineups. That's there waiting for a burger and fries.
Yeah.
So what is that? Does that come out of this family business that cares about others? I mean, I don't know. Is that too corny of a question?
No, I don't think it is. I don't know. You know, people often said to me, customers would say that their weekend, their Muskoka experience started the minute they got out of the car at Weber's. That was sort of the starting point.
Nice.
And so we saw generations of families come through, you know, little kids coming through and then bringing their kids through. And so it became
for weekenders.
Absolutely.
Right? Because they'd probably stop a couple times a month.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we'd see that. And there was just a real loyalty. And there, you know, one of the things that Mr. Weber Sr. did was pick an excellent location. It is really about halfway. And so it's a natural stopping point on the way home as well. You're not too close to home. So you sort of say, forget it, we'll eat when we get home. So the location combined with, you know, a dedication to doing things properly has grown that business to the point they're serving, in my day, and it's probably a lot more now, but serving over 8,000 people a day.
It's a lot of customers.
A lot of hamburgers.
That would explain the lineups.
It was a lot of fun too. Like it was. I mean, it was hard work.
Well, but you
it
was can really fun. Hear you've got a great deal of fondness for the place, and for the people, and for the experience. So it sounds like you were you going sideways at the time when you got the job? We don't have to go into that kind of detail if it's too painful for you.
We can bore your listeners to death with my story.
But it's interesting to me, you know, those moments, right?
Yeah.
Those epiphanies, those right decisions or Why did you make that choice? Yeah. Here's, you know, and now, you know, this many years looking back, you go, how would have things been differently if I hadn't have picked up a spatula?
It would have been, you know, that's a really good question. And I don't know the answer to it, but definitely one of the things that I learned quickly there was, you know, not, being a huge hockey fan, but not being a very good hockey player, you know, being not very academic.
Just describe those Canadians.
yeah, exactly. Certainly. It was one of the, you know, it was one of the first things that I became good at, and I became, you know, not to sound, you know, I became really good at it, as did all my friends who worked there. So it was a sense of accomplishment, of pride. Mr. Weber was an incredibly generous individual. So we paid for our schooling by working there, and we, you know, we worked, you know, long hours, quite willingly. It was an influential piece of my forming into adulthood, and we would sit and talk after work, and we would talk business and talk about life, and, you know, we had many late night chats there as a group, as we you know, finished mopping up the place and stuff, and so all those things enter into it. It was that type of experience. So lots of, if I think back on, like you said, at the time, probably not realizing what you were in, it is was a really formative part of my career.
Would you, so I'm an electrician by trade. I don't know if I've told you that in the past, but yeah. So 8,500 hour apprenticeship. You probably don't need quite that many hours to cook burgers, but you still learned a great deal over that period, 13 years, that period of time. Would you consider, were you mentored, these late night chats, would you consider it kind of a mentorship? Because sometimes when I sort of not even get nostalgic, I remember those days with fondness. You know, the journeymen and a few women that I worked with in the trade, you know, those relationships that developed and the knowledge that was passed on that you didn't even know about until years later, right? The things that you picked up, it's not like Paul would have got out the whiteboard or the chalkboard back then, but there were sort of, you know, lessons being communicated. Does it make sense?
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. And it's absolutely explains what was going on there. And it was a mentorship quite naturally and quite you know, unregulated. I learned more about business, frankly, working there than I did in, you know, 5 years of business school.
Wow,
and we're talking about the nuts and bolts, right? The block and tackle, quality service, cleanliness, how to treat people. The power of a thank you, the power of a written note, the importance of a really white, crisp shirt, you know, and how to deal with people under incredible, you know, volumes and pressure. You know, this place moves fast and it's warm in there. So a lot of really good lessons. And, I could talk, on and on about many of those, and all very much. And I had no idea I was going to enter a career in the restaurant business. In fact, I sort of fell into that.
Other than kind of what you're doing now with CEO Global Network and your time at Canadian Tire, you're pretty much hospitality.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. I've been very fortunate, and I've loved the career, most of it. And truth be told, not all of it, but most of it. And it was, at the time I went, got involved, it wasn't considered to be a very glorious way to go. My friends were doing things that were much more, professional.
Right.
So, I was a restaurant guy, and it gets into your system, and anyone who's spent their career in the restaurant business will understand. I'm sure it applies to other professions as well, but it gets into your blood, and you start you get good at it, and it becomes a source of income. And
any kind of vertical or any kind of a club, a real subculture, I would think.
Yeah.
Like, I can imagine what some of those conventions might be like.
Absolutely.
Talking about silverware late into the night.
Yeah, that's right. It's work hard, play hard, right? And that is the business. And it can be done really well. And it also can be dangerous for people at times as well. But there's many, many success stories. And, the organizations I've been with, often you'll see an area manager or general manager of a restaurant go on to work in very senior capacities, including CEO of organizations, and they got their start in the kitchens of a restaurant. So it has that ability to, if you have a good attitude and you have a work ethic, it can provide a lot for you. And there's lots of people who could talk about the good fortunes they've had of
Do you think you're a better CEO? Do you think CEOs are better CEOs starting out sweeping floors and flipping burgers?
I don't know. I'm probably...
And that can be... That's a metaphor. That's an analogy for any business, really.
I'm probably more critical of myself than complimentary as my performance as a CEO. What I do know is that serving people is a pretty important part of leading an organization. And if you learn how to serve people at a young age in a genuine fashion, you know, your job as a CEO, as a president, is to serve. It's not, and when you're leading a group, you're not telling them what to do. You're trying to bring the best out of them. And you and I both know it's all about the people. And so a lot of those skills that are learned and the ability to roll up your sleeve. And so the good thing about our business is, you have to be able to walk into a boardroom and present a strategic plan. But you also have to be able to walk into a restaurant and be understood and listen and be current and present with the current staff. And they'll know if you know. And so I really enjoy both of those things. And so I've often thought about the fact that those are completely different environments to be in, but both critically important. So one's facing the customer and the other one's, running the business from a strategic point of view.
So you clearly have some pretty, I was going to say well-informed opinions, but they're way beyond opinions. You've worked with a lot of leaders. You're setting out to start up a new global network of CEOs that are getting together to commiserate and to serve one another, I suppose you could say.
Absolutely.
In a way. What have you learned along the way? I mean, you talked about a clean shirt, the power of a thank you. I mean, those are awesome things, right? Really simple things.
Right.
Are you going to write that, the 5 points to great leadership someday? Is that
coming? I actually was on a plane the other day. I wrote, which I need to work on, I wrote the 11 things I learned flipping hamburgers.
Nice.
And I should have brought it with me, actually, but I'll show it to you later.
I'd love to see it.
But there's a part of me that I'm not the best writer in the world, but the part of me that those lessons learned are important ones. And one of the things I'm looking for in my group as I fill chairs around the table is looking for leaders who share in the spirit of generosity. And that's something I learned deeply at Weber's. And I just don't mean financially, although I include that for sure, but generosity of time, of thought, of giving back. And so quite often, those types of people are people that I would be attracted to put into this group, because it's an important function of an executive peer group is to, if it's all take and it's not give, it doesn't work. So it's a matter of coming in and me helping you solve whatever challenges you have, and you doing the same for me in a confidential and caring manner. And so, but if you're quickly, the culture of the group would quickly dispel someone who wasn't transparent or genuinely interested in being generous with themselves.
So tell me and our listeners, what is the CEO Global Network? I mean, it sounds like a community, obviously, but a community with a pretty intentional purpose. Kind of, is it a Rotary Club for CEOs?
I mean, there'd be many similarities to what people would gain from Rotary in terms of the colleagues and being around like-minded business people. It's about CEOs who want to learn, who are constantly trying to learn, improve their lives both professionally and personally, and who have a desire to get better at what they do. And it does help CEOs learn to manage both, and I won't use the word balance, but you know what I mean by that. It might be prioritize is a better way to. And so it also is incredibly helpful to have that level of accountability. So when you come in and present an issue to the group, a month later you're back and people are asking, how did we make out with that? Yeah, and if you haven't done what you said you're going to do, being a CEO or being a president, being a senior executive can be a lonely job, and people don't tell you the truth. They just don't. So you get around a group of people who are there for you, they tend to get to read you pretty well. And if you're not, if you're kind of misunderstanding your issue or not being forward with it, they're going to pick it up.
So was the Global Network created because it is kind of lonely at the top?
Absolutely. And the CEO of CEO Global Network will tell stories about some of the darker moments he had as a CEO and wished he had this type of format,
right,
to be able to go and say, I've got this major problem. What would you, the men and women around the table, what would you do with this in a structured way versus just on the golf course with your buddies saying, I got a problem. Uh, So that's the essence of the power of an executive peer group.
You know, it's interesting. I love your comment about you're looking for your group anyway, the one that you're beginning, you're looking for leaders who share in the spirit of generosity. I wouldn't normally think, you know, unless you've gotten, you know, deeply into, I don't know, Covey or Carnegie. I just read recently, I actually interviewed a guy recently, Larry Scanlon, a journalist who's written The Year of Living Generously about 5 years ago. And he spent a month with a nonprofit for 12 months overseas, locally. And just basically, it's a book of stories and the lessons that he learned along the way. It's fascinating, really. It is. And then at one point, he said, basically, David, my 300 pages is a book about generosity.
Right.
And he talks about Carnegie. Carnegie gave away, and he was financially generous, but he was also generous in other ways too. $350 million, late 1800s to early 1900s, worth about $8 billion today or something. So clearly the Warren Buffett of his time.
Huge.
But like you said, not only about money. If we went back and looked at great leaders, Churchill and, you know, some of these great leaders, is that what we would think of? Would we find that about? I mean, isn't the first thing that springs to mind for me. I'm encouraged by that, mm-hmm. to be honest with mm-hmm. you. And then, of course, I want to spring forward and go, is that what our younger generation is learning today as they go and move into the business world to lead, you know, the Walmarts and the Harveys of the world?
I sure hope so. The people that I admire and that I've had a chance to work with, I would say almost exclusively share that trait.
Really interesting.
Just really interesting. And, you know, you think about the Canadian Tire Dealers Association.
You've buoyed my spirits.
That's really good. If I can generalize, the dealers in that network who are hardworking, successful business people are generous beyond belief, but in ways you never know about. You know, they're not overt. They have overt charities that they support and stuff like that. But they're very community driven, and they do a lot of things that just don't hit the radar screen. That are because that's sort of the way they are, and they give back. You know, Dave Thomas, Wendy's was a generous person and part of the mantra of Wendy's was you give back. You have to give back.
Part of the culture.
Part of the culture. And you know, you can interpret that. That's a broad statement.
Of course.
But you and I would both interpret that maybe a little bit differently, but that's okay. On your thought process every day is not just about what's in it for me.
My sense is, and wow, I know nothing about Dave Thomas other than some commercials and a few articles that I read about him, you know, and maybe after he died. But I got the sense that he might have been a generous guy day to day too, kind of in the way he led, like I at the office. Maybe not. Maybe he was a complete prick.
No,
from the top down. But I kind of doubt it.
No, he. I mean,
so you're saying generosity is not just at home, working with, you know, local community-based organizations. This has got to tease out. This has got to come out in your day to day, 9 to 5 as well.
Absolutely, and you know, you've been an avid networker over the years as well, And the really good and the really successful networks, when you sit down and say, what can I do for this person? What can I do to help them? And there's oftentimes you're in need and you need to help. You need help. And I would encourage people to ask for that help when you're in need. But, you know, the really successful interactions where you're trying to help other people. And we all fall victim. I mean, Lord knows I've been, you know, in my career, been in times where focus has been predominantly on me because I've been in crisis mode or whatever. Or as a young executive, when you're, you know, young family and you're just trying to make ends meet, you tend not to maybe have that or you don't display that spirit as much as you'd like to. So as you get a little older in your career and you have a little more time and perhaps have a little more energy for it, you know, it's a pleasurable thing to do, and it's the right thing to do. And there's always there's always someone out there who needs a little bit of a leg up, or, you know, well, like a little attaboy in the back once in a while. So it doesn't have to be anything grand, you know. One of the things we talk about is the spirit of gratefulness, and you can be grateful for a really good cup of coffee, or you can be grateful for a really, you know, big leg up from someone. But it's the same thing with generosity. It can be small acts, and you see the sort of movement, the small acts of random kindness, where, you know, where people are, for example, paying for at Timmy's drive-thru for the car behind them just because they feel like, those are kind of interesting things.
Mm-hmm. And I think, they really, you know, are.
That's what, that those are, you know, many would argue those are the most critical things you can do, because you can, you know, I'm an optimist. I think you can make the world a better place by doing small things on a regular basis. And if we're all doing that on a regular basis, the world just becomes a little bit better place.
I think when you look at some of the, and again, we're going to go financial now, but it's not just that, but you look at the bigger donators, you know, the Gates and Buffett and some of these family foundations that are giving away millions every year. It's not just about that. It's about what they're doing with the money, how they're focusing. You know, Carter decided to get rid of guinea worm disease, and boy, they're awfully close. Rotary went after polio, and right. You know, these were like all these individuals. I mean, I went to a Rotary meeting recently. It was 7 a.m. start. Who gets up for breakfast to be there for 7 on a weekday? And you know, we go in and they're taking pledges to raise money for some water project somewhere in Ethiopia or wherever the heck it was.
Yeah.
Brilliant, right? It doesn't have to be over there. It can be right here as well. And I just, you know, always encouraged by that kind of, community, I suppose. Right. That kind of generosity, as you say, that kind of gratefulness. I love the way you said that balance might not have been the right word, but priority was.
Right.
That's kind of interesting to me. Can you tease that out a little bit?
Yeah, I like to work, and I like to be really involved in stuff, and so, and it's personal, right? There's my level of involvement in a project is my decision, and it's hard for someone else to say, you know, you work too hard on that, and I also like to take time off. I like to enjoy I like to enjoy life outside of work. So, I think it's just a matter of being strategic and planning, because you know the business world moves quickly, and so to say work-life balance to me. I don't know anybody who's struck a work-life balance, who walks around and says, I got this figured out. So it's about prioritizing as the worlds collide your personal and professional life. And and there's times where my daughter is a chartered accountant, and there's times where, you know, there's no work-life balance at all because of the demands of the tax season. But there's other times where there's a chance for her to, you know, come up to the cottage and relax and take time. So it balances out in the longer run. But so she works really hard at times, and it's probably too hard, but there's other times where there's a payback. So I just think it's more of an awareness level, and what's right for you might not be right for me.
So what I love about your global network is that's the kind of thing you're going to draw out, it seems to me. I mean, I don't know what these guys are like, and I know you're just kind of starting out in Barrie.
Barrie,
Ontario. Yeah. But, you know, when you get together with a group of people, I mean, isn't that what makes a great party? You're commiserating with somebody. You're oh, really? You know, you might not say, wow, you're suffering from the same thing I am. But you kind of go away feeling validated, feeling encouraged or whatever, you know. And it seems to me that a network like that allows you to hopefully prioritize, you know, maybe it's time to shorten your to-do list. Right. And a group of your peers, you know, they might hold a little more weight than, say, your friends at the local pub.
Yeah.
Right?
I
don't know.
You're onto something there. Yeah, I was in a meeting as a guest a little while ago. One of the group leaders has a very established group, and we got in the room, and they do spend time talking about, they check in at the start of the meeting time, but, you know, out of 10, how are you doing business-wise, and how are you doing personally? And you put like an 8 out of 10 or...
which is so great, because as if you could separate the two.
Right.
This is what I've always, you know, when you try, oh, well, this has to be separate from, no, hang on a minute.
They're intertwined.
And they're becoming more intertwined. Absolutely. With devices and working from home and all these things.
Well, if John were here, the CEO of CEO Global Network would tell you that they're absolutely intertwined, and what makes it, what successful CEO do you know that has a beautifully run business and a disaster.
Right.
I mean, we all have challenges, don't get me wrong, but I went to this meeting as a guest and introduced, and they went around the room, including myself, and we put, you know, the number up, and what struck me was, and these are confidential sessions, but what struck me was just the candidness of the candor of the people around the room, saying, you know, the things at the shop are good, but boy, oh boy, you know, my 17-year-old son is, and the group were very supportive, and so sometimes it's just good to get stuff off your shoulders, you know.
Yeah,
and you ran on the table, and almost everybody had it. So you walk away, not, you know, not encouraged because they're having issues, but you walk away and go, you know what? I'm not alone in this world of challenges. You often think that other people maybe have things figured out a bit better than you do, and it's just not the case.
It's just so often not the case, and we so are not alone, and it seems to me it's the kind of thing that we need to be reminded of. Certain of us need to be reminded of it more often than not, and I'm one of those people. I need to know that I'm, and it's interesting because I've been kind of consulting on my own now for years, and I feel right. as if I'm at a bit of a transition where, you know what, I'm not done with that. I still like my time on my own to create and write and do the different things, but there's something really rewarding and energizing about hanging out with other people of like mind. And sometimes it doesn't have to be of like mind. In fact, isn't, you know, and let's connect this back to leadership. Doesn't a great leader get people around him and her that are going to disagree with him? Or at least challenge them? I mean,
I would often, you often hire for your, when you get to be at a certain level and a certain age, you understand your shortcomings. They're evident. Everybody around you knows them for sure.
Right.
Better than right. Good point. And if you are self-aware and you've been the benefactor of 360 feedback, you hire to compensate for those roles. And I'll honestly tell you that if you, my experience, if you can let your ego stay out of the picture, which is not easy to do for a lot of us, and let the people around the table, when you selected the A players, and they have to be A players. You can't do this. Mm. B players will have C players working around them. So if you've got an A team, you got to get out of their way. And we talk a lot about this. And it might be that you've got a 6 or 8 person executive team. Your idea might be the worst one at the table. And when it is, you're probably doing a really good job. And I mean sincerely that, not sort of the... not sort of the pedantic kind of, idea is better than mine. I really like, that's a really good idea. Because I don't care about authorship. I care about the best idea going forward. I care about building the business. I care about the development of my people. So if you can set the ego aside and have A players, and the A players love it when you get out of the way. In fact, when you're really doing your job, they push you out of the way and say, you know what, Ryan, we got it. Like, just, you know.
So you're not going to believe me, but just last week, I was speaking to an organization and a fairly high leader within the organization, certainly not at the top, large organization, who admitted to me that maybe a lot of the director, senior director levels within the company wouldn't probably hire their equal or better because of concern and fear and just the vulnerability that might create.
Right.
Wow, I'm not going to bring in somebody who's my age or who's has more schooling than me. And I was really blown away by that, but it makes a lot of sense. Do you think that's a real problem of a lot of companies, a lot of organizations?
I think it is. And I think the ones that excel don't have that problem. You know, they encourage it, and they encourage conflict. They encourage professional conflict. They encourage respect. But
right.
I come from a family of 6 kids. And
respect with professional conflict.
Absolutely.
Is great.
You know how to fight. You know how to have a good fight. And when you're wrong, which is quite often, it's nice to admit it. And people will cut you a lot of slack. You know, when you get in front of a group of franchisees and you're wrong, and you will be, often just admitting it is the first step to getting it right. And so with executive teams, if that fear factor is in the culture of the organization, it will hamper performance for sure.
Well, and so much of this, I mean, we got to talk about it in a second here. Sadly, we've got to wrap it up in a few minutes, but I definitely want to talk about top down and bottom up and so on. But so the fear, to get to that place where you can encourage respect with professional conflict, it's got to be a truckload of trust, it seems to me, or at least, maybe it's just respect.
It is trust, and trust is something you don't write on a, on the board and say we're a trusted organization. Trust is challenged by every decision you make every day and your reaction to those. So people watch you in leadership positions carefully.
Of course.
And you're tested every single day in ways you don't even realize you're being tested. So you have to be present all the time. And that's, that's what makes the job a little bit lonely and a little bit tough at times, because you're always on. I mean, there's no room for a bad day. And we all have them. So if that trust is not there, or if there's 3 instances where the trust is shown and then the fourth one it's not, that's the fourth one, the one that's going to get remembered. So you have to take a long time to build that bank account back up.
Are great leaders vulnerable? Are they open around coffee at break time saying, you know what, I'm kind of having a crummy day, guys, just so you know?
I find them to be exactly that way. And the ones who aren't are usually, you know, covering up insecurities or inadequacies. So the really good ones are really open. And it's quite striking sometimes, the candid conversations you have. And they are open to feedback, you know, because
you talked earlier about self-awareness, and I mean that's a great path we could go down too. I mean, you know, how do you become self-aware, right? Especially as a leader, if you're trapped in some sort of weird structure or crazy organization or whatever, or unhealthy home life, you know, how do you break out of that and go kind of shine the light on the darkness over here for a little while? And
you're conducting a one-on-one with a senior person in your organization, or anybody in your organization. You can ask them, well, what's the number one thing I can do for you today to help you? And at the end of the discussion, asking them for a little feedback on you. It's easy to do. It's free. If you do that on a regular basis, people will get comfortable with that, because wouldn't you rather know? Wouldn't you rather hear? And you know what it's like. Sometimes you take a deep swallow and say, really? But it really helps. And I think the great organizations that I've been lucky to be with some fantastic ones. There's a real spirit of feedback. In fact, in many organizations, you're expected to, you know, to be in that vein, in both being your ability to receive it and your ability to give it, which is sometimes very hard for people as well, is to be able to be honest and candid. And Lord knows I could share all sorts of examples with you of things that didn't work out well.
Right,
as I do.
Of course.
I'm talking about
these are ideal situations. These are ideals.
Yeah.
These are, I guess, ways of seeing and ways of living, right? I mean,
right.
this is you know, not going to happen all the time.
No.
You know, I have a friend who's I went to high school with, Thistletown Collegiate Institute in Etobicoke, Rexdale, actually, I grew up in, and he's the CEO of a large company in Montreal, and he said to me once, you know, you got to hire, and this must be, it's a little Jim Collins-like,
sure.
But, you know, you got to hire great people, David. Don't hire good people. Hire great people. And you know, you talked about A players.
Yeah.
If you've got A players in the room and you've got trust, wow, you've got you're more than well on your way. How do you get to the great people? I mean, is it six-figure salaries? It's got to be more than that.
It is more than that. We talk about this a lot. This is something at CEO Global that we talk about, how to hire, how to train, how to, you know, keep A
and
players,
how to keep
them. Part of the strategy for that is what I said earlier is getting out of their way and letting them truly be,
because
A players, you know, the minute the challenge and the learning is gone, they're gone. You know, they're on to the next one. But compensation, definitely, you know, it often isn't the number one. In fact, rarely is the number one. But good young talent know they're good and they know that their market values are. So you have to pay market or slightly above. Isn't it nice if you go to apply for a job and your salary expectation is, you've got a range, and I come in just slightly above your high, even if it's $5,000, and you go home and then you go, guess what?
Yeah.
I had my high, and why not?
Well, we're back to an increment in the scale on the scale of generosity. It seems to me,
right?
Wouldn't that? Wow, what kind of company am I now working for?
Absolutely.
They offered me more than I asked for. Like, what a nice starting place.
And it really doesn't matter at the end of the day,
for a large firm, five grand a year over 10 years
it's well worth it. So,
yeah.
So, and then, and, you know, good people, attract good people, and, the culture of the organization is so critical, and always being on the lookout. You know, a good CEO, good president of a company is always on the lookout for good talent. Like, everywhere, all the time, you know, there's that law of attraction that enters into it, you know, it's not about ping pong tables, and, you know, I mean, those are nice things, they're great and everything, but you can't force a culture that through those means. So it's a full time job finding them, keeping them, challenging them, and then, you know what, once in a while, you gotta let people move on, and there's often times where I can't offer the opportunity that, you know,
that you've got elsewhere.
So you know what, what goes around comes around. Off
sure,
you go,
sure,
and, and
sure.
Congratulations.
I love what you said about getting out of their way. I mean, I immediately go to some of the roles I've had over the years where you were micromanaged, and, you know, you were pulled into an office 4, 5, 6, 7 times a week, or the phone would ring and you'd go, no, please, it's not. It's him. And like physiologically, there would be a shift. I've had a couple of those relationships where you're just, we got to wrap it up, but we're at my top-down question, I guess. And I'm not even sure what it is, but I think you've kind of already answered it, frankly, with, be a human being is a good leader. Be generous.
Genuine.
Be gracious. Be genuine. Be vulnerable. I mean, get out of people's way. Holy cow. I mean, what I'm thinking of now is Robert Fulghum's book, Everything I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. Have you ever read that?
No, I haven't, but I should write
you
that
should
down.
Write it, yeah. You should read it. Honestly, it would take you a couple hours on the deck, with a Weber hamburger.
That's right.
But it's a small book, and it's kind of, and the idea is, again, it's relational, it's community, it's treat others well and with respect and all these things that it seems often we do forget. Ron, so let's wrap it up here, but one of the things that I worked in banking for a while, and I thought that there was a different ethic during the day that people worked with than they would have taken home at night. From 9 to 5, it's okay for me to screw you because it's just my job. But once I get onto the GO train, I'll behave a little differently. And I probably have examples. I don't have anything right now. Do you think that is... It's almost like my misbehavior was justified because it's just my job. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but I don't buy it. It makes a lot. We can justify just about anything if we put our minds to it, right? We're great at that. But often in organizations, saying what needs to be said or doing the right thing takes a ton of courage. And it can cost you your job.
Maybe that's the reality.
But,
right?
I think if you have a set of values, and Lord knows I've been in those situations where it's impacted me both positively. I've been rewarded for it and been hurt by it. But it's a value system. I think you in leadership, you shine a spotlight on your people. If you're going to let get out of their way and let them do it, you have to allow them to make mistakes.
Right.
And when they do make mistakes, you get in front of the bullets. So you give them all the credit for everything. But when the going gets tough, and if you get up and stand up and take a bullet for your teammate, team member, direct report, whatever, those are the testaments of a true leader. Mm. And nothing ever goes perfect, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think just from a personal point of view that you can be Jekyll and Hyde and lead a successful career.
It's been a long time since I've been out of that culture, that corporate culture, and it was one of many. I would like to think that's going by the wayside, that's old school, that was one department, right? I mean, years ago I learned in the trade that you're only as good as, the company's only as good as the person you're working under. I mean, there's so much truth to that, right? So I don't want to just paint corporate subculture with that brush. But.
For sure. And you want to separate out, purposely harming someone from competition, because competition is fantastic and needs to be in every facet of business, including competing with other companies, but also there's competition within organizations that is really healthy as well. So I'll separate that out just a little bit.
So can you give us one of the 11 things you've learned? And is it going to be a book?
I don't know. You'll have to help me with it. One's going to read it.
We're going to talk more about that. But have you got a title for it yet?
No. I just was on the plane.
I can see some of the cover art. I think
A number of people have mentioned it to me. So you should try and write it down.
That's a great idea.
Because my wife has stories that I've told so many times that she's asked me to kindly retire them. So I just have to keep meeting new people like you so I can tell, because I'm in love with my stories.
You've got to write a book and get it out of your system. And then maybe make some money doing it. Who knows, right?
Well, one of the things that I learned that would be one of the 11 is Mr. Weber would marvel at the cleanliness of some of the suppliers' trucks. And so... So the metaphor is that when you're doing business in public and there's a certain supplier that come out and they had the cleanest trucks going and it was just a tribute. It's often like you go into a washroom of a restaurant, you kind of judge the cleanliness of it. You really notice it. So when you're delivering to a customer, all those things matter and being proud of your emblem, proud of your family name, proud of your company name, and putting your best foot forward. or little things like having a really clean truck are really, really important, especially in our business.
So. The little things, it's almost like we wrote that in, because that's been my mantra for years now. The little things make a big difference, and you know, incremental change, and you know, just, you know, random acts of kindness, all that kind of stuff. So there's been a real lovely thread, I think, in our conversation today. Thanks a lot for your time, Ron.
I
wish you well with the book. I really mean that. I think I can see it on Indigo shelves, man. I can see the cover. And slowly creeping up to overtake Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
We've got 400 colleagues rolling their eyes right now, going, "Oh my God, he's going to write a book. We're in real trouble."
Yes. So, the 11 things I learned flipping hamburgers. Well, Ron Botta with us today, talking about leadership, and we didn't even get to your bridging strategy, but maybe that'll be for part two.
Well,
and thanks for your time today, Ron.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me on.